Shall we begin? With your leave, I would speak for maybe 20 minutes and then open it up to discussion, if everyone is okay with that. We are told that England is a conservative nation, and that the idea of rebellion and revolution is foreign to these shores and merely a foreign importation, and that we have no history of revolution in this country, which is distinctly, I would suggest, not the case. In discussing with the English Revolution, I'll begin with a couple of the issues. The first issue being land. In the 1640s, a third of England was called common land. It was where anybody could raise their cattle, could collect firewood. It was owned by everybody, and that was in common law. The process began in the middle of the 16th century, whereby the rich began to seize that land, began to enclose it, and began to fence it off for their own use, namely the production of sheep to assist the growing textile industry and make profit from it. But there was always resistance to it. In fact, in 1603, James I, the king, visited Northamptonshire and was mobbed in his coach by a crowd of people. 7 years later, that had grown to outright and complete and utter rebellion, and parts of Northamptonshire were no-go areas for the authorities. In the 1620s and the 1630s, the same was happening in the southwest. I think it was 1636, there were an incident in Gillingham where troopers who were sent to quell the rebellion against enclosures actually mutinied and joined the rebels. Fences would be put up by day by King's commissioners and the men of the gentry who were seizing the land. By night they would come down. King's commissioners would be thrown out of villages by people rebelling and acting in a uproarious fashion. There were riots in Dorset, riots in Weymouth, riots all over the West Country. In Norfolk, where there were attempts to drain the fens that people used in common to fish and to get reeds for building houses, there were attempts to drain the fens so the land could be used and reclaimed and again used for agricultural purposes by the rich and the gentry, and in the same way the rebellions in the Fen Country. So while it's portrayed that England was at peace until the Civil War, far from it, parts of England were in a state of complete and utter rebellion. This was also a time of economic hardship and economic crisis. Quite often there were famine, quite often there were grain shortages, which led to an increase in the price of bread and severe hardship. And people dealt with that by direct action, by seizing grain. In fact, in 1608, there were incidents in Southampton where rebellious women seized an entire shipment of grain from a ship and sold it off to the ordinary townsfolk at what they deemed to be a reasonable price. And throughout, especially the West Country, that was common. It was common for barges going down the River Severn full of grain, either to export or to be used in the malting industry, to be seized. And people would either distribute it amongst themselves or sell it at a decent price, and maybe even give what they thought was the decent price to the people who owned the grain. But they took direct action. In the 1620s, there was, again in the West Country, a depression in the textile industry, where master textile workers, clothiers and weavers, were forced to lay off their labourers, which led obviously to destitution and hardship. The authorities were forced to take measures to prevent that from happening, because the poor would simply band together in groups of 60 or 70 people and would go to the houses of the rich and demand money and demand food. So the authorities were forced to do something about it. I will also relate a slightly more light-hearted tale of an attempt in 1631 of the authorities in London, probably the Puritan authorities, to close down the brothel. And in them days, this brothel owned by Mrs. Holland was in quite a big house, a big medieval house, which in the case of many big medieval houses was fortified and had a moat around it. So the troopers who came to close down the brothel were invited, in effect, to come in and discuss the matter. And the prostitutes in the brothel waited until the troops were on the drawbridge and then dropped the drawbridge into the moat, which of course was a cesspit, and then proceeded to pelt the troopers with piss pots and any other missile that came to hand. and it took three attempts by troopers to actually close down this brothel. Such was the veracity of the people involved in defending it. We can't discuss this period without going through religion, which I'll do briefly, as a spectrum. Because on one hand, you had Roman Catholicism with its wealth and its land and its priests, bishops and archbishops, and its stained glass and its gold and its altars and its priests in fine robes. And it controlled Western Europe for 500 years till the Reformation. And then in England, you had the Reformation under Henry VIII, which saw the establishment of the Anglican Church, which still had priests and bishops and wealth, but was less ornate. It didn't have stained glass. It got rid of altars in many places, and the priests were quite plainly garbed. Then you had the real Reformation, which came from below, and it came from Europe, the Puritan Reformation, which in many ways was an attempt to intermingle religious desires with desires for democracy. So you had the Presbyterians, who didn't have priests and bishops. They elected their own councils, although the Presbyterians still wanted their religion to be the national religion. And then you had the Independents, who, as far as they were concerned, people like Baptists and Congregationalists, wanted people to worship as they saw fit and churches to operate as they saw fit, and saw no need for a national religion. And then on the other end of the spectrum, later on, you had ranters and Quakers, people who thought that God was in everything and God was everywhere and society should be run without recourse to heaven or sin or any priests whatsoever. The Baptists, in fact, would have a sermon, and it was usually by a lay person or in some churches an elected person, and then they would sit round and they would discuss the sermon democratically to see what lessons could be drawn out of it. Now, at this time, King Charles, a bit of a power freak, and his Archbishop William Laud wanted to establish their form of religion on the country. They were both very much into the idea of theatre and show and art, so they started to bring in altars and bring in finely garbed priests into the Church of England, which upset some of the Puritans. They also repressed religion that they disagreed with and wanted to impose their religion on the country. Charles started this off by imposing his prayer book on the Scots, which was not a very good idea because they were strictly Presbyterian. And the first time the prayer book was read out in St Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh, one woman at first responded to the reading out of the prayer book, which they disagreed with, by rising from the stool upon which she sat and throwing it at the bishop who was reading out the prayer book. This resulted in a hailstorm of stools, Bibles and other missiles being flung at the bishop and the high and mighty sat at the front of the church. Eventually, the protesters was got out of the church and then did what any good protesters do. They stayed in the vicinity of the church or the cathedral and put the windows through. The high and mighty had to run to Holyrood Palace to escape under an armed guard. And this happened all over Scotland. It led to an uprising in Scotland and what's called the First Bishop's War over religion, as Charles tried to install his version of religion on the Scots. Now, for a war, you need money. And in this case, the only way of King Charles raising money was to call a parliament, which was problematic because if you call a parliament, parliament wants the king to listen to their demands and their queries and their problems. First parliament Charles called to raise money for the war was in April 1640. It lasted about 3 weeks because they wouldn't grant Charles any money for the war. All they did were go on about their grievances, which Charles didn't want to hear. So he abolished that parliament, which led to widespread rioting in London, especially on the 11th of May. There was a riot at the Archbishop of Canterbury's house, and one person, John Archer, who led that protest, was put on the rack, tortured and executed, the last person to be tortured on the rack in Britain. Of course, people were very courageous in those days, and it didn't really put people off from engaging in such things and engaging in direct action. But still, there was a desire to elect a parliament because that was the only way that ordinary people could have their grievances met. Some of the gentry wanted a parliament as well, and they opposed the king. And the king, although he was desirous of arresting these peers for treason, was in effect prevented from doing so. One, because there were mutinies in his army, especially in the West Country, where there were mutinies in the army that in some cases led to officers being seized and shot, and also because he was afraid of the people. And by October of that year, you had the situation where the King's High Commission, based at St Paul's Cathedral, was attacked by about 2,000 Puritans, and parts of the cathedral where the King's High Commission sat was trashed. Nonetheless, in November, he was forced to call Parliament again to get money for his war against the Scots. The first thing Parliament did was release three Puritans who, a few years earlier, had been prosecuted by Charles's Star Council and had their ears cut off, and one of them had B for blasphemy branded on his forehead. When these three people who had been released by the Parliament got to London, there was in effect demonstrations of thousands of people opposing Charles and in support of the released prisoners. Charles wanted to arrest the leaders of the peers who ran Parliament, but was frightened of doing so because he was frightened of an uprising in London, which gave Parliament enough time to arrest the Archbishop of Canterbury and arrest the Earl of Stafford, who was King Charles's right-hand man and who was accused of treason. One, because whilst there were no parliaments have sat and Charles ran the country independently, he was the architect of that personal rule of Charles, that dictatorship. And two, because he was Lieutenant of Ireland, he was accused of wanting to bring in a Catholic army from Ireland, because there were fears in London of re-establishing the Catholic Church. So at the behest of the people, in effect, and with the support of the people, Charles was emasculated, the King was emasculated, and Parliament was able to arrest Charles's principal supporters. There was also at this time a petition drawn up by the people of London for the Church of England to abolish bishops, archbishops, deacons, and in effect scrap the entire hierarchy of the Church of England. That petition was had 30,000 signatures. It was presented in December of that year to Parliament by 15,000 people, and 500 actually got into Parliament to put their position forward. But the main thing before Parliament would discuss that was it wanted to deal with the question of Lord Stafford, the King's right-hand man, who had been impeached. Now, meanwhile, the Archbishop of Canterbury was under the custody of Blackrod, the ceremonial leader of security of the House of Commons. Blackrod tried to fashion the escape of the Archbishop of Canterbury and tried to smuggle him out of London in his own coach. Now, this was spotted by apprentices somewhere in the vicinity of Newgate, who immediately started to call the alarm and realised that there was an attempt for the Archbishop of Canterbury to escape London. The alarm went up, people rallied round, and before long there was 1,000 people surrounding the coach and surrounding the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they refused to desist in their demonstration until they had escorted the Archbishop of Canterbury into the Tower of London and to safety. Or at least safety as far as the people were concerned, not particularly in. On the question of the King's right-hand man, the Earl of Stafford, a petition was immediately got up to pass a Bill of Attainder, because Parliament had not actually been successful in prosecuting him for treason. A Bill of Attainder would mean that Parliament could execute him anywhere without that legal process. That petition was of 20,000 signatures was presented to Parliament on the 21st of April 1641, among huge tumults and huge demonstrations. On the 2nd of May 1641, there was an attempt by King Charles to counter-strike. In other words, to organise a coup and seize control of the Tower of London. And there was a plan which was organised by King Charles's officers to get troopers together, numbering 100 troops in the centre of London near a tavern, and then, in effect, they would march on the Tower of London. Only 60 troops turned up. The person in charge of the operation vacillated and hesitated, by which time the troop movements were noted, and again the call went out, and 1,000 Londoners descended on the Tower of London to defend it and prevent the coup d'etat. Once the Tower of London had been secured, the people refused to go home and stayed on the streets, and thousands more joined them, and they went to Westminster to demand the execution of the Earl of Stafford. And it even got to the situation where there were so many people at Westminster that the Lords who were entering the House of Lords to discuss the Bill of Attainder could not get into the House of Lords until the people parted and allowed them through. And of course, lords who were sympathetic to executing Stafford were allowed through. Others were stopped and barred. Bishops were not allowed in. The king himself could not get to Westminster because he was stood at the river in his barge and was too afraid to enter Westminster, because by this time there were crowds of 15 or 20,000 people, of which one, John Lilburn, said, "Today there are thousands of us. Tomorrow there will be hundreds of thousands of us. Today we come armed only with our staves. Tomorrow we will be armed with our swords." And the king had no choice. Under pressure from the Houses of Commons and the Houses of Lords, under pressure from the people, the king signed the death warrant to execute his own first minister in effect. And he did this with the words, "If my own person was only was in danger, I would gladly venture it to save Lord Stafford. By seeing my wife, children and kingdom are concerned in it, I am forced to give way to it." The historian Clarendon, who was alive at the time, said of the tumults, "There is no greater counterpose to the weight of the tumults." In other words, in London at that time, neither the power of the king nor the power of Parliament could defeat or stand up to the mass organisation of working people. Just to go into what demonstrations would have been like at this particular moment in time. So what was protest like at this time, where people were really exercising real power in London? We know that flyposting went on, and in fact, at this time, the people who, or the lords who were in support of the Earl of Stafford, had their names posted up, pasted on the walls of London, and other messages were pasted on the walls of London. There was graffiti, distinctly. Doubtless people made placards, probably out of bits of canvas that they found about. Bedsheets at that time were far too precious to be turned into banners. There would have been leaflets such as this, which is in its original form. There was chants and protests, chants for execution and justice, chants for freedom and bread. People may ask, when it comes to protest at this time, it may concern us, the simple question, would there have been people selling copies of Socialist Worker? Not quite. But the city was awash with pamphlets. Pamphlets going on about religious issues, pamphlets going on about political issues. We go forward 6 months to the Grand Remonstrance, when a list of 200 complaints against Charles's government was written up and presented to Parliament. And again, it was presented by thousands of people turning up to Parliament. Charles again tried a counter-strike, and he did it by deposing the person who was in charge of the Tower of London, who was sympathetic to Parliament, and trying to impose one of his own persons, someone called Colonel Lunsford, who was known as a drunkard, arrogant, and the term first became to be used, cavalier. Soon as people heard about this, people flocked to Westminster. Word would have got round. London was a smaller place than it is now. The streets were very crowded. It would have been very easy to put the word out. The word would have been put out in churches, in taverns, in the marketplace. And as soon as people learned of this, thousands descended on Westminster to prevent it from happening. Charles realised his mistake, changed his tack, got rid of Colonel Lunsford, even as the protesters were assembling at Parliament. They were assured then that their demands had been met, and that Colonel Lunsford was no longer the lieutenant of the Tower, and they did what any good protesters do. They stayed on the streets. They stayed on the streets and decided that they would vent their spleen on Parliament, and they prevented any bishops getting to Parliament and getting into the House of Lords. They demanded that the bishops were impeached, in effect that the bishops were arrested. And because they actually prevented the bishops going into Parliament, they exercised their power. The bishops were impeached by Parliament under protest by the people, who forced them in effect to do it. So you had a situation where the Archbishop of Canterbury is in the Tower of London. The King's First Minister, in effect, has been beheaded. And when he was executed, 200,000 people turned up to watch, which is amazing considering at that time London had a population of 400,000 people. At the same time, you had ordinary preachers, people who were, in one case, a fisherman, in one case, a glover, people who had ordinary trades, who were preaching sermons in London on religious questions, but also on social matters, to crowds of thousands and thousands of people. The ordinary churches in people's houses that had been repressed by Charles suddenly flourished, and with that flourished ideas as well, which were social ideas. King Charles again rallied and decided to seize power back by arresting his five main enemies in Parliament. So he drew up a warrant for their arrest on counts of treason. He got to Parliament and they fled. And he was forced to leave Parliament without arresting these people, with the chance of privilege and Parliament ringing in his ears. In other words, that members of Parliament should not be arrested by the King. That chant was taken up in the street outside by thousands of ordinary people who came to Parliament to defend Parliament. A long cry from the way position people may take today. The next day, the King went to the Common Council of London, a council of the gentry, to explain his actions. The council broke down in uproar, with half of them shouting Parliament and privilege, and the other half of them shouting God save the King. This is the beginning of January. On the 6th of January, he dined at the house of a gentleman in London, Sir John Garrett. And while the King was dining at this gentleman's house, the people still on the streets, bear in mind, surrounded the house, and the King had to flee in his coach for safety. It was pursued through the streets of London by crowds of hundreds of people. The Lord Mayor and the Aldermen of London was toppled from their horses, and the Lord Mayor had his ceremonial chains ripped from around his neck by housewives, and they were forced to flee and they were forced to walk home. Charles, meanwhile, on the 10th of January, had had enough. The King of England left the capital. He'd been forced to leave by the power of the people, in effect, chased out of his own capital. This is the beginning of the Civil War as such, which I won't go into, apart from to explain that the first victories in the Civil War on the side of Parliament were inflicted on the forces of the King, not by Parliament or by parliamentary armies, but by ordinary people. In Essex, there were an instance where the people of Colchester rose up and 5,000 people marched out of Colchester to the big stately home of Sir John Lucas, who was the main supporter of the Crown in that area. And they trashed his house, and they seized his weapons, and they took them back to Colchester. The same thing happened in Suffolk to the house of a Mrs. de Rivers. A crowd of 2,000 trashed her house, relieved her of her arms, relieved her of her wealth, and made it impossible for the Royalists to organise in these areas. The Marquis de Hertford, on the side of the Crown, who had land in the West Country, was sent to the West Country to raise an army for Charles. When he got to the city of Wells, he found himself surrounded in the surrounding area by 40,000 armed people. These would have been ordinary people, farmers, clothiers, traders, craftsmen, armed with pitchforks, hunting rifles, billocks, blades on sticks used to trim hedges, any makeshift weapons they could bring together. When he got to a place called South Moulton, he was dining with the local dignitaries in a tavern. And they suddenly realised they were surrounded as all the townspeople descended on the town, occupied the market square and forced him to leave that particular town. When it came to the actual fighting, before Parliament in effect had an army, certainly many of the cities of England were defended on the behalf of Parliament by ordinary people. Birmingham, the gentry fled and left the ordinary people, craftsmen, nail makers, tool makers, to defend Birmingham and actually fight off Royalist siege. In Manchester as well, the parliamentary gentry fled, leaving it up to the local gentry in the surrounding areas to resist a Royalist siege. Ordinary people flooded into Manchester. The local gentry lost the battle and wanted to surrender, but the ordinary people, which numbered hundreds of people from the surrounding areas, stayed at the post and refused to surrender until the Royalist armies had withdrawn. In Bradford as well, a very small parliamentary force in a city which was considered undefendable because of its situation and its location and its lack of a city walls, were reinforced by hundreds of local people who flooded into Bradford from the local area, clothiers, miners and ordinary people who resisted the Cavalier invasion and who defended successfully the city. The moral of the tale is, I think, and the lesson of the tale, is that we have had a revolution in this country. The English Civil War was an uprising, in effect, of ordinary people. They may have engaged in supporting Parliament as a better option than to the autocratic rule of Charles, but Parliament could not have beaten Charles without that revolution of ordinary people. I will leave it there. It is a vast subject. I only intend to scratch the surface. But I would just like to leave with one story from later on in the Civil War, when Parliament had won and the new model army had been formed and had defeated Charles. And Charles was imprisoned by Parliament, which at this time was a mainly Presbyterian majority, who wanted to do a deal with Charles that they would put him back on the throne if theirs could be the national religion. And the ordinary people and independents in the new model army, irrespective of what the leadership of the new model army said, went and seized Charles and put him in the custody of the army. Bear in mind that at this point the army had organised rank and file committees, soldiers' committees, to defend their interests. And independently, without discussing it in great depth, without bothering to have any bureaucracy or without asking the leadership, ordinary soldiers went and seized Charles. And it was led by someone called George Joyce, who was in effect a corporal, a very low rank. And when they went to seize the king turned to this person and said, "But what is your commission? What is your authority?" And he just pointed behind him, and Charles didn't get it and said, "Yeah, but what is your commission? In other words, what right have you got to come and arrest me?" And he said, "This is my commission," and pointed to 500 troopers behind him. The message being, the authority in England at that time, in many places throughout that period, was ordinary people. I will leave it there. Any questions, comments, discussion?
Have you got some of the... I'm very interested in the literature that was put around at that time. Is there a collection of works from that period or anything like that that you can go and look at some of these pamphlets and what was being said?
I have, in its original form, a Ranter pamphlet by Ebiza Kopp, which we've got on store.
Right.
You can get, and it's in book form here on different stalls, the works of Jan Hardwin Stanley the Digger, which I think was a manifesto for anarchism. It was the Communist Manifesto before the Communist Manifesto, and easy to read. And here and there you find Leveller pamphlets as well. So it is about on the internet in its original form. Some of it's difficult to read because it's in Old English. Certainly Win Stanley is a delight and a joy to read. It is out there.
Tell me again what that collection is. It's a fella called Win Stanley.
Gerard Win Stanley.
Right.
Yeah, the Law of Freedom in a Platform and other writings. Gerard Win Stanley being one of the leaders at Diggers. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Would you talk to say a bit more about the Diggers?
The Diggers?
Yeah.
Well, I think Win Stanley's work, the Law of Freedom in a Platform, when he in effect a concise anarchist or communist manifesto for the time, and he talks about how society would be organised, and society would have huge warehouses, and people would produce things and take them to warehouse, and people would take things, so in effect you didn't need money, and the Diggers themselves were a social phenomenon of landless people. Gerard Win Stanley himself had been come from Wigan, and he'd been apprenticed to the textile industry in London, and he'd set up trade, and because of the Civil War he'd lost all his money and lost all his trade, and like many people formed a commune on St George's Hill, where as far as we know they just farmed the land in common and distributed the goods between themselves, and then that movement went out and spread to other areas around London, Buckinghamshire, Ivory, Kent, Northamptonshire, very much anarchist communes. But his writings are really good and really important, and I think that's probably one of the best known and probably one of the most important highlights of this whole period with the Digger Commune. They only lasted for about 12 months, 18 months before they were repressed, but certainly in that time they built up a lot of writings, and of course these pamphlets would have been distributed in London and distributed around the country, and very much fomented the development of anarchist ideas, although of course the phrase weren't around at the time.
There's certain things I found when we're talking, we don't want Parliament or King, we don't want walls made by rich folk who don't understand what it's like for us to live. It's really is so inspiring to read, considering it was 350 years ago or more.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
It's an amazing firmament, and I think, I mean, certainly studying this period as directing my own attitude towards fighting austerity, because what it shows is there is no substitute for people on the streets for direct action. And you had a situation in history where the King of England were defeated by the direct action of ordinary people, his armies were defeated by that direct action. So I think one of the most important lessons is that's what we need to be getting back to that attitude of getting out there and doing it and staying on the streets, and in a very disrespectful way of authority. It's quite impressive for the way at times demonstrators were told, yeah, we'll listen to your demands, you'll go home, everything will be alright, and they didn't, they stayed out there and continued to protest.
They may have had a smell that everything wouldn't have been alright if they'd all gone out back here tomorrow.
Yeah.
Same again.
Yeah.
It's amazing how little changes in 350 years, isn't it?
Indeed, yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that the anti parliament like, think there's much conflict between like people who stood up to defend parliament, knowing that like it was the lesser evil of parliament versus king, or do you think there was like an infighting between the anti parliament people?
Well, there were an infighting between parliamentary forces, because you had the Presbyterians who wanted their religion to be the national religion, and on the other hand you had people in the Parliamentary Army Independents who were fighting for religious toleration, for no national religion. And of course you had that tension of, in the Parliamentary Army there was the gentry who had been disenfranchised by Charles and wanted a voice, but they didn't want everybody else to have a voice. So you saw the likes of the gentry, the likes of Cromwell and Ireton, who got in power and thank you very much, and then ordinary troopers who were saying, but we fought for this, we demand the voice, we want the vote. And that was the thing about the Levellers wanted an extension of the vote, not as we would see it, because women weren't included, but nevertheless an extension of the vote. So you had that. After the Civil War, you had that mass movement at Levellers and big demonstrations and mutinies in the army when they tried to fight for the vote, religious toleration. Also, on the Levellers programme was the right to education, a welfare state and things like that. So there were them tensions in the army. And while it was a revolution against the king, there were those who wanted to take it further and have a revolution for democracy. And those who wanted to take it even further, like the Diggers and Ranters, who wanted to abolish all private property and establish anarchism in effect.
Did the state have a secret service at the time?
Well, the people of London in 1640s had an advantage in there were no standing army as such, and there were no police. The only force was the trained bands, which was a part-time militia, and of course most of them supported the demands of the people, so the king couldn't rely on them. As to the secret police, there were networks of the king's and the archbishop's agents who were keen to suppress dissent and suppress Puritan ideas and seize Puritan pamphlets and revolutionary pamphlets, because at this time you couldn't produce literature unless it had been stamped by the king's stationery company. So there would have been a network of spies and such. And of course, as a result of Civil War, you got distinct royalist and parliamentarian intelligence groups forming. In fact, the main royalist parliamentarian group was called the Seal Knot, where the Reenactment Society gets its name from.
Do you
So I think those things developed as time went on, and there were those aspects of a secret police there, but distinctly more informal. It would have been paid informants, not full-time employees. It would have been, here's a bag of money, you keep your eye out on these taverns here and that sort of thing. Well, I think I did a workshop at Manchester Anarchist Bookshop, Book Fair, and it, of the 30 people or so there, no one had done about the Civil War at school. It was
I was schooled in Manchester, and I did zero about Civil War.
Mm. It's as if it's if did you did something. Yeah,
but it was nothing. We didn't go anything about revolution in the house. It was just about Wormen was about trials. Cromwell,
yeah,
and how Charles was beheaded in Cromwell's grave
when he was in the war. It's very much not talked about, but if it is talked about, it's very much of the way history's normally taught, which is a clash between personalities, Charles and Cromwell, and the influence of local people, the ordinary people, don't come into it at all. So I don't know whether that helps.
Just like the different groups, like the Diggers and the Puritans and the different groups like that, do you think they've been tarnished? Well, I guess they have been tarnished with history, but how do you think, even though you would say, like, Roman tyrants like won the war, do you think they've had a fair crack at having being a member of history? That makes sense.
History's distorted and it's simplified. It's like, yeah, it's seen between two different personalities. But it's also, you get that impression of parliamentarians were Puritans and therefore they were miserable and against sin and against drinking and fornicating and dancing, and of course Cromwell banned all that, but the parliamentarian cause were much wider than that. So you get that impression that comes down to us through history that's not entirely accurate, because it was a firmament, so there were all sorts of revolutionary ideas, and on the ranters who indeed in a sense believed in sin and believed in promiscuity and believed in drinking and things like that and people doing what they wanted, they all emerged out at the same camp of Parliament. So I do think it's remembered in a very black and white way. Charles, Cromwell were a Puritan, therefore miserable, banned people enjoying themselves, therefore people were happy when the monarchy was restored. Very simplistic, not accurate.
Certainly never seen it portrayed as a revolution.
No.
Just, I think there has been at least one really good television programme about the Diggers. All I can remember really is crying at the end. It's sort of out there,
Is that the black and white film, Win Stanley?
It might be.
Yeah.
As I say, what I mean is crying at the end, and of course the song.
Yeah. The two good pieces of cinematography on it. There's the black and white film called Win Stanley about the Diggers, and then there's the Channel 4 series called The Devil's Whore, which is set around a fictional character. And some of the characters in it are factual characters, but they've changed exactly who they were. But nonetheless, it does go through the stages of the revolution, from understanding it and the army, and then the levellers and the suppression of the levellers and the Diggers. It does go through that quite in an interesting fashion and quite an earthy fashion. But one of the things that is quite good, because I think people on the left don't even know this history, because it's been locked away in academic books, which is why we did the pamphlet. But we do have, like, there's a Diggers Festival in Wigan every year. There's a Diggers Festival in Wellingborough every year, which I only found out about a few weeks ago. There's a leveller event in Burford to commemorate the mutiny in Burford and the three martyrs who were killed by Cromwell. That's a bit of a corporate trade union event, really, but nonetheless, it's still good events by which we can remember this history. But as you say, a lot of people, even on the left, don't realise that King Charles was chased out of London by his own people, and that the first victories of the Army of Parliament was uprisings of ordinary people. And I think people on the left, certainly it would be useful to have more cognizance of that, because that is the directions, rather that is the tradition of self-organisation and direct action of which we are coming from, I think.
I think again with the sort of historical thing, and going back further, when you see things like the Peasants' Revolt, I'm sure there were, that within that, there were sort of threads within threads, and who was, who was revolting about what, and what they were hoping to get out of it, is much more complex than what you hear exactly about, and some of it's lost. But I'm sure, there's always, in a lot of people's hearts, that we want to be free, we want to chuck all this off us, and there's moments when someone rises up, and it might be not exactly the one reason, but then for another reason they all start jumping around in the fields and not doing what they've been told to do.
It was the third group. They didn't want the king. I don't want Parliament. I don't want either. What did they do? Well, did they chuck the lot into one or another, or did they just go their own way and do their own thing?
There were in effect there were levellers who wanted Parliament but with democracy, so all heads of households could vote.
Right.
Limited from our point of view, a revolution in 17th century for democracy. So they wanted to extend democracy and have, in their eyes, a proper Parliament. But then there was the diggers who realised Parliament had become corrupt and just saw the future in people seizing the land, seizing the commons, working the commons to eradicate poverty. And then the ranters who saw that, again, the way forward was, people living their own lives and abolishing private property. And I suppose Win Stanley's vision was one whereby, because he talks about communities and he talks about villages, and in effect he's talking about ordinary communities running themselves without any recourse to Parliament. So that would have been, in effect, the third way of which you're talking.
Right. Like an autonomous collective of various groups together.
Yeah.
As opposed to having a structure and an
authority. Yeah.
There are also those, it's hard for us to understand today because we don't have the concepts in the language, but they often say in religious terms, and that quite substantial numbers of people say that also it's a religious revolution, realising, Christ's kingdom on earth. Which again, to us, sounds very backward, but at that time it was in itself revolutionary. And then as a sort of change in society, the social struggle and the politics wasn't set up from the religion part of it. And groups like today, like the Quakers, was quite revolutionary at that time. So it's a sort of a world that we're not really familiar with, but we've got to understand that that's how they proceed, the world of their time.
Mm.
And I think that, and it goes back again with John Paul, who was a preacher, who was going around, and his thing was, when Adam dealt with his span, who was then a gentleman? So obviously he's using the Bible to say, we're all the children of Adam and Eve, but obviously that's not where most of us would come at it. But he's saying, we're all level, we're all the same, all that on top stuff.
It does smell a little bit of someone else just trying to take power for a different reason now, doesn't it? I bet there were a few of the diggers going, he's got a book that says what? Not that diggy.
Well, I think that's one of the lessons, and someone mentioned it at Manchester Anarchist Book Fair. One of the lessons is, and we still, as in the left, are still learning it, maybe not anarchists, is that you can't trust people of power. Cromwell, Ireton, were people of power and privilege and wealth, and they sold the revolution out. And you cannot trust anybody who seeks power, any MP, any trade union bureaucrat, official, any councillor or anything like that. Ultimately, you can't trust them. But on the question of religion, of course, the Bible were the main reference point for a lot of people. And when you read the Bible, there's horrendously reactionary bits in, and yet there's beautifully radical bits in. And Ebenezer Cope, in his Fiery Flying Roll, quotes the Gospel of James, chapter 5, I think it's verse 6, and he's warning the rich, and he's quoting the bit in James that says, "Your gold and silver is cankered. Your gold and silver will rise up as testimony against you, and it will eat your flesh as if it is fire." And that verse goes on to then say, "And remember your labourers who mow your fields, for their unpaid wages that you have withheld will rise up as testimony against you." And Abiezer Kopp finishes with the words, "Hold all things in common, or the plague of God will rot and consume everything that you have." So, I mean, John Ball talked about that England could never be at peace until all things were held in common. And Win Stanley talked about the earth being the common treasury of all. And people did use that religious allegory to put forward distinctly political programmes.
I'm sure someone was saying that even before the Bible was written, the Bible stole it off there because it's coming out of people.
Yeah,
no, yeah, early yeah. Grecius, and there's some fantastic stuff in early Grecius world to create the Bible with.
Yeah.
It's heartwarming to look at it and read it in a way that there's something about religious verse that isn't.
Yeah.
And a lot of religious verses really nice when you get to the bottom about the values of doing about God or some kind of eternal. So you read like a couple of sentences, you think that's a lovely bit of verse.
Yes.
And then we stick some on ending. Do you just think, why did you have to put that in it? Mm. It was great until that bit. I went to a funeral recently, it was exactly the same. I sat there biting my teeth all the way through it, but thinking this is a really nice verse if you just knock that last couple of lines off and upstairs. Mm. Not the choir.
Mm.
So, I can't help but think we use this as a bit of a way.
I'd like to be a bit of a devil's advocate, really, because I'm really sceptical about using history for any kind of ideology, whether it's anarchism, socialism, or any other one for that matter, because I think it's incredibly dangerous and incredibly slippery. For instance, this idea that this kind of virulent Puritanism, which actually had infected a lot of states in Europe, affected governments, went right to the top of these organisations, somehow represented some kind of anarchistic movement, I think is really problematic. You think about the kind of things that they wanted to ban, the kind of things they wanted to stop people from doing, the kind of authoritarian tendencies that they had. You could argue that they actually then became realised in the during the Civil War in terms of the extreme disciplinarian and authoritarian regulations that were introduced and imposed on the masses and on the populace. I also think that there's this tendency to think of, getting rid of the top dog is what the revolution is all about. Just because, they killed a king, somehow that represents the kind of revolutionary movement, and I think that's really dangerous as well. It's happening in modern day, in the modern world, isn't it? You're getting these uprisings and they're getting rid of their dictators, but they're not succeeding in getting towards any kind of society that's any better, because you just then get another really dangerous head taking their place. We're seeing this in these Arab Spring and the rest of it. So I think it's really dangerous to sort of take these models, idealise them, and see them as a kind of continuity in any kind of thought.
I see that point, but at the same time, without looking back into history to see what's happened and mistakes that we've made, and to be able to look back and think, well, this has been done before, and look what happened, it got turned over again. I think we've got to have an element of looking at that to find what works and to find inspiration for what works. But I agree that sometimes you can become the thing you hate, you don't care. Mm. Not to spout anarchist theory and then become a master telling the folk we can't do X, Y, and Z. It's a complete hypocrisy in itself. Which is why I asked the question, what happened to the third lot? The ones like me who didn't want either. I don't want any of you. Just leave me alone, please.
Well, I mean, Ian touched on that, because it was the group the ranters and the Quakers and the diggers who did believe in the personal transformation thing. So it wasn't enough just to get rid of the king. They got to change the relationship between themselves and society. Yeah.
The short answer is they all got killed.
Yeah.
Some of them disappeared, actually. We don't quite know what happened to them. Maybe they went to America, but they got
driven down. And
well, I know in America they had a similar thing, didn't they, where they all fled to the border of Canada and suffered the winter, and a lot of them died in the savage winter. Well, those who made it became the frontiersmen on the border of Canada, and that was how a lot of those towns were formed. People fleeing the Civil War of America.
Fleeing with passion.
It made me think other parts of England where groups of people, when we don't want any of these, let's come on.
I think one of the things that happened, there was repression, especially under Cromwell, and then after monarchy was restored, but there were a lot of people like Win Stanley, John Lilburn the Leveller, Richard Overton the Leveller, who probably exhausted because of the years of political activity in prison and everything, retreated into Quakerism, quietism of Quakerism, which, as Alan says, were quite a revolutionary force at that time. So which in and of itself still try to abolish hierarchies, try to be egalitarian. But you're right about the thing about Puritanism, but on the scale of things, the Puritan Revolution was an intermingling of, in the widest sense, the struggle for religious democracy intertwining with political democracy. In other words, no church hierarchy, but you elect your own church hierarchy. Still authoritarian, because it's still messing up people's heads with sin and redemption and a lot of mental illness caused at the time by people obsessing about sin. But nonetheless, the what you could call Puritan Revolution fed into this firmament at Civil War, which then led to ideas of ranters, Quakers and the diggers, where you had no sin, and God was however you wanted to interpret him, and God was everything, and God was in all of us, meaning everything's important and we're all important, in a sense dissembling the idea of God in its traditional form. So I think that were, I agree, but that were, it's part of a continuum, and I think our time is spent.